There's a lot of talk about states' rights, except for when it comes to guns. No states' rights there, which is interesting. Conceal carry, fine. States can't make rules about that. Carrying a baby, apparently, is a different topic altogether. So, this weekend, I read the original Roe v. Wade decision. And I'm not sure a lot of people have done this. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides a fundamental right to privacy that protects a pregnant woman's liberty to abort her fetus. Part of the 14th Amendment is your right to liberty. So this made-up right to privacy, which I can't imagine why any citizen in this country wouldn't think you have a right to privacy. You might be shocked to learn it wasn't until 2003 that Texas sodomy law was overturned. What you're doing in the privacy of your own home is not the government's business. The other part of the Texas sodomy law was that they were only applying the law to homosexuals. And you can't be any more unconstitutional than when you make a law and you target a specific group. That will be overturned 100% of the time. In the ruling of Roe v. Wade, they found that during the first trimester, governments could not regulate abortion at all, except to require abortions be performed by a licensed physician. Makes sense? Now, during the second trimester, governments could regulate the procedure, but only for the purpose of protecting maternal health and not for protecting fetal life. That doesn't come until the third trimester, which we refer to as viability. That'll even extend into the last few weeks of the second trimester. With the exception of the mother's life or her health. Now, also cited in this decision was historian James C. Moore, who recorded there was an earlier acceptance of abortion in America. Opposition to abortion, including the anti-abortion laws, only came to being in the 19th century. So one of the things the Supreme Court, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas cited specifically, was that abortion was not part of American tradition. And that's incorrect. See, long before ultrasounds, it was referred to as quickening. That was when you first detected movement from the baby, which happens to coincide with what we know as viability. With technology today, a baby born at 20 weeks could be kept alive. According to Leslie J. Regan, a professor of history and law at the University of Illinois, pre-quickening abortions were legal under common law. Like in early modern England, our sets of laws were based on the common sense law of England. It was a widely accepted practice, abortion, in the early United States. The majority opinion for Roe v. Wade, authored in Justice Blackburn's name, would later state that criminalization of abortion did not have roots in the English common law tradition and was thought to return to the more permissive state of pre-1820s abortion laws. You might be surprised to know Connecticut was the first state to pass an anti-abortion law. They didn't criminalize it for the women. Often they would bring in the women to find out who had performed the abortion and who else had participated in the planning and procedure. The court introduced the concept of a constitutional, quote, right to privacy. And it had been intimated in earlier decisions, including Meyer versus Nebraska, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, which involved parental control over child rearing. You have a private right to send your kid anywhere you want, to any school you want, to give them whatever education you want, for them to practice whatever religion they want. It's all part of your right to privacy. And of course, there's the hot one, Griswold versus Connecticut, which is next on Marsha Blackburn and Mitch McConnell's hit list. They want contraception next. They're going to tell you when you have sex, the consequences are the consequences. You want the government deciding that for you? With virtually no further explanation of the privacy value, the court ruled that regardless of exactly which provisions were involved, the U.S. Constitution guarantees of liberty. Liberty, not privacy, your right to liberty, covered the right to privacy that protected a woman's decision to abort a pregnancy. I just a little while ago heard talk of California and a law allowing abortion 48 hours after giving birth. That's nonsense. Something about the way the law was written, nobody intended it to be that, and it didn't pass. There are no such thing as late-term abortions. Elective late-term abortions don't happen. You can't go in at 9 months and say, I don't want to have this baby. That's not how it works. Also, a post-birth abortion would be murder. You'd be killing a living, breathing baby. I'll also point out that under Jewish tradition, life begins at your first breath and life ends at your last breath. This is a very specific Christian doctrine about life beginning at conception. Nobody else believes in that. The Supreme Court didn't buy it either. That's how that was found in 1973. Now, again, understand technology has changed. You can have an abortion on your lunch break and go back to work and finish the day. It's actually a safer procedure than carrying a baby to term. So, in essence, the state is actually putting a woman's life at risk. So when women say lives will be lost, that's true. Not every pregnancy ends up being viable. There's a law in Texas currently that any removal, even of a dead fetus, your baby dies in utero in the state of Texas, this was even before the overturning of Roe v. Wade, until the 37th week, that baby could not be removed. They were sending women home with dead fetuses in their stomach. You have to naturally push that out. Imagine the pain and the mental anguish of knowing you're going to give birth to a stillborn baby. This isn't birth control. No one's talking about abortion as birth control. Look at the stats. 90% of abortions, 90% happen in the first 20 weeks. So this is a small problem that people are really focused on when it comes to abortion. And again, these abortions in second and third terms are generally related to the well-being of the mother. A lot of bad information going around from people who probably know better. Connecticut's diesel tax is going to jump 9 cents on July the 1st. The 23% increase follows a year in which diesel prices have nearly doubled. Been reading a lot on this. Joe Scully is the president of the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. He's also a buddy of mine. And Joe, I saw your name in every single one of these articles for obvious reasons. What is the argument, Joe, that I've been hearing is that most of the people being taxed are out-of-state truckers. First of all, is that even true?
Hey, Joe, good to be on with you. And no, it is not really. There's a couple numbers I can give you. The state says it's about 100 or 115 million in total diesel tax revenue that it gets every year. Now, I also know that through IFTA, IFTA, which stands for International Fuel Tax Agreement, that's the system that allows us to collect diesel tax from out-of-state truckers. We only get about $15 million a year from that. So $15 million a year is obviously a small fraction of $100-plus million a year. So that argument really is not true.
Joe, that's kind of what I thought. That's kind of what my research was telling me. But you're the man. I figured you know better. You had also retweeted Something economist Don Klepper-Smith says this diesel tax hike, quote, couldn't come at a worst possible time. It means the cost of goods and services is going to increase across Connecticut for the next 6 to 12 months. Obviously, if you guys are having to pay more to ship it because of these diesel prices, you are going to see the prices obviously crawl up in the store. And we already know that things are already bad price-wise.
Yeah, and, you know, you've probably seen me talking about for a while now, really any increase in cost that hits the trucking industry, whether it's a diesel itself, the diesel tax, tolls, higher driver wages, anything that is a cost on the trucking industry generally has to get passed on. We operate on thin profit margins, and we're just not sitting on, you know, piles of cash to the point that we can absorb these things. So I've been saying it for a while, but with the price of diesel surging, finally it's become part of the national conversation. You're seeing national economists talk about it, economic experts here in the state talk about it, and they're saying what I've been saying. So I'm glad to see that, because it's a little bit of validation for, I feel like, a year or two or three down here. Some of the powers that be were saying, no, that's not going to happen. The trucking companies are going to just absorb it. Well, when you've got Don Klepper-Smith, a well-respected voice by everyone around the state, saying it, okay, yes, I agree with him, obviously, and that message is getting out there. And it seems like there's only a few holdouts within the state who, I don't know, may have an anti-truck bias that don't want to have that conversation. But I think finally the message is getting out there.
So the Connecticut trucking industry pays 33% of all taxes owed by Connecticut motorists, a third of all the taxes from Connecticut motorists, despite representing only 7% of vehicle miles traveled in the state. So again, sort of to your point, you guys are paying the bulk of this.
Well, we're paying a lot of it, and I think what makes it even more frustrating is, where does the money go that we pay, right? The argument is, and look, we all agree, things have to be paid for. Highways, roads, and bridges have to be paid for. And we, as users of those things, have to pay our fair share. But when we pay, a multiple of what our share of use of the road is, and then that money gets spent on things that have nothing to do with roads and bridges, whether it's on pension funding or trains or buses or just getting swept to the general fund. And then the government comes back and says, you guys aren't paying enough. You got to pay more. That's the part that is so frustrating to the small business owners here in Connecticut. And most trucking companies are small business owners. 91% of trucking companies in the U.S. have 6 trucks or less. So just because the physical truck is big does not mean it's big business. Yeah, sure, there's a few big trucking companies in this country, and they're paying, you know, millions and millions, perhaps billions of dollars in total taxes. But it's the small businesses that are based right here in Connecticut that have such a hard time with, the tax discussion, because they pay so much, and then where does it go? And then the government comes back to them for more, like it's their fault that the money got diverted or swept or spent on other purposes. So that's what I hear from members all the time is, you know, hey, if it was truly an issue of we're spending the money on exactly where it needs to go, and we're running out and we're not taking in as much as we used to, and we need to raise taxes, maybe that would be a palatable conversation. But that just is not what's been happening over the last few years or even few decades, to be honest with you.
There are 17,470 trucking companies here in Connecticut. You mentioned the 91% with 6 or less. 97.4 have less than 20. So again, these are small businesses here in Connecticut and around the country who are bearing the brunt of it. And then, again, you get to the grocery store, and it's easy to blame you guys.
Yeah, and that 17,000 number, I want to talk about that for a second. If you go back a year or two, the number was 7,000. And that is per federal records, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. Their records show that there were 7,000 trucking companies in Connecticut. Now, with the most recent data, 17,000. Now, a trucking company, or the proper term is a motor carrier, can just be one person with one truck. That's a motor carrier. And that's the biggest reason we've gone from 7,000 to 17,000 is people are going into business for themselves. And so, again, super small business, they're the ones being hit with the high cost of diesel, the diesel tax increase, tolls in states where there are tolls. It's the smallest of businesses. It's a person who has chosen to go into business for themselves as an owner operator slash independent contractor. They can least afford any increase in cost. And if we see an economic downturn, I know there's some discussion of will we, won't we, is that still to be decided? They're going to be the first casualties of this, and they're going to be hit the most with this 9 cent per gallon diesel tax increase that's going into effect in a few days here. So, you know, I know there's calls for a diesel tax suspension, right? And look, to be fair, the diesel tax is adjusted once per year based on a statutory formula. And yes, it has gone down a couple times over the past couple years. But we don't need this money right now. Our transportation fund actually has a lot of money in it. We're on a gas tax holiday. Let's give the small businesses a break. Throw them the smallest of bones and delay this diesel tax increase, if not including the entire diesel tax in itself into this holiday. And then it'll come back in January like the gas tax.
Well, Joe, like you see, too, they're going to cut my gasoline tax. I saw what the savings are for the cut. It's like $25 a car. It's not anything substantial, but right by raising it, the diesel tax, they're going to make my groceries cost more.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, look, diesel powers our supply chain. It fuels almost all trucks and cargo ships, by the way. So, you know, food is on diesel-powered trucks in order to get to the grocery store, and gas and home heating oil and clothing. And just think about everything that you buy, everything that you can see around you right now. It was on a truck at some point. So that's a cost that the trucking companies have to factor into their operations and most likely do their best to recoup one way or another, whether it's a higher rate they charge the customer to get the food to the store or a fuel surcharge or some combination thereof. It's a tax on the supply chain is what it is. And that is one factor that's driving up costs right now for consumers.
I'm on the line with Joe Scully, the president of the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. We were talking about this diesel increase that is scheduled for Friday, and just the enormous amount of responsibility that falls on the trucking industry. And obviously, Joe, we have a serious issue with our supply chain, and when you're looking at industries that are most reliant on trucking, you'll find some of the areas where prices have definitely gone up. One being lumber, dairy, fruit, vegetables, agriculture, and pharmaceuticals all use trucking to transport their products. What has led to, I think I saw something too, Joe, like that you guys need to hire like a million truck drivers in the next 10 years to keep up. Am I in the right ballpark there?
Yeah, I was going to say it's not the only factor, but one factor is there is a shortage of truck drivers. The number that we peg for like this specific moment in time is there's a shortage of 80,000 drivers, right? We could put 80,000 drivers in jobs right now, and everyone would have work to do. There'd be nobody that didn't have a load to transport. So that's wow. That's one factor, right? I mean, if you have more product or more freight than you have capacity, a.k.a. truck drivers and trucks in which to put that, you have a problem. We call it a capacity crunch. And that's, you know, that's one factor that's led to inflation, again, among many factors. But what happens is the shippers start bidding amongst themselves. I'll pay this for-hire trucking company you know, X amount of money to haul my freight. And then a competitor says, well, I'll pay them X amount plus 10%, right? Because they want it more. And that's what kind of what we call a capacity crunch, that just not enough trucks, not enough drivers to haul to meet the demand that is out there. And we're 80,000 drivers short this year, but if trends continue, it's a crazy number over the next 10 years that we need to hire. And a million, I think that sounds about right. And that's why we support anything and everything as far as outreach to recruit new drivers for the industry.
Is the state of Connecticut or is the federal government doing anything to help you guys get more people in the industry?
Yes and yes. So, you know, good news there. We worked on multiple pieces of legislation that passed at the state level this year, from helping people who are about to end their term of incarceration take the knowledge test. It's a test you need to pass in order to get your learner's permit so that when they come out, they can go straight to a CDL training school or straight to a trucking company and learn to get their CDL while on the job there. There's federal COVID money that's going to be put into workforce programs here. And there's a third thing about a revolving fund, what they call an income share agreement, which involves drivers paying back. It's not a loan, but paying money back into the fund once they have a job making more money than they used to, which is probably going to be very easy because truck drivers can make very good money right now, and I don't see that changing. And the feds did some things, too. They established a pilot program that would allow 18 to 21-year-olds to learn how to drive in interstate commerce. That's currently illegal. I know some people are concerned about that. I don't think there's a lot to be concerned about. There are many safety checks in place to ensure that only the safest individuals, the safest trucking companies that are adhering to many extreme safety checkpoints can take part in this pilot program. So there's a number of things that are in the works, and we hope and we think it will pay off in the near and long-term future.
Joe Scully, president of the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. I know you're a very busy man, Joe. I appreciate you making some time for us today. Be well, and I will talk to you soon, my friend. Very excited for my next guest, former Darien First Select woman. She, back in May, won the GOP nomination for the fourth congressional district. She'll be running against, has to beat a primary opponent in August 1st, but is lined up to hopefully face Jim Himes this November. Jamie Stevenson is what she calls a new breed of Republicans. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us.
Joe, thank you very much for having me this evening.
So, Jamie, last time I was on, I tried to get you on, and you canceled just before the convention, and I totally got that. You wanted to focus in on getting the nomination. So I do appreciate you coming in now that you've got that locked away. Although, just sort of explain for everybody, Michael Goldstein is still trying to make a push, right, for the primary in August, even though the vote wasn't even close.
Correct. I was so honored to receive 91% of the delegate votes the evening of the congressional convention. Of course, part of the process, as we know it, allows for the person who wasn't selected to collect signatures to get on the ballot for an August primary. So that is, in fact, what Mr. Goldstein has done.
Okay. Couple of things about Jamie. First, I mentioned you call yourself a new breed Republican. We'll get into that in a minute. You're also a board member at the LifeBridge Community Services in Bridgeport. And very exciting news, as of Friday, you have an official campaign headquarters in Fairfield. This is, and I was, Jamie, the reason I wanted to talk to you so bad was because I think you are exactly the right kind of Republican candidate who could win in the state of Connecticut.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that vote of confidence. I certainly believe so, too. That's why I stepped up this year. As you stated, I served as Darien's first selectman for 10 years. I retired myself in November because I believe in term limits. There aren't any. So, I made significant contributions with my team to the well-being of our town, our region, and our state. So I passed the torch to Monica McNally. But I have to say that so many things have occurred over the last year. Probably most poignant for me was the unforgivable way that the United States government pulled our military out of Afghanistan. I really couldn't believe, you know, I have a lot of people in my family that have served proudly in the military, and what we all witnessed as a nation is not at all what I believe America stands for in terms of supporting our own military and supporting our allies across the globe. So that really was my impetus for getting into this race. And now, you know, there just are countless issues that are troubling Americans today that requires new leadership voices, people who have common sense, who are pragmatic, who understand about the economy, who understand the needs of families. And I believe that I'm the right candidate this year.
You've been described as independent, as libertarian. And again, Jamie, everybody who I've talked to about you, you have gained respect from a lot of people. All the people you've dealt with seem to really hold you in high regard. Again, another reason why I'm excited for your candidacy. Let's hit a couple of campaign issues. We'll save the big one for the other side of the break. We'll start a little easier and we'll work our way. Inflation. I know you've been kind of outspoken about this. 8% inflation. The price of food, the price of gas, the price of everything is through the roof. And I think you're sort of hanging a lot of this on the stimulus. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, I think people, you know, it's hard for people when they hear the political rhetoric, you know, the talking points about, you know, the percentage increase and 40-year high inflation. But what does that really mean for people and families? It means that it costs over $100 to fill your gas tank with gas. And, you know, if you're a independent business person or an Uber or Lyft driver or a delivery person, and that's part of your everyday living, or if you're just doing carpool for your kids, your life is dramatically impacted. The fact that we had to airlift baby formula from Germany into the United States is something that I never would have imagined. As a mom of five and a grandmother of two with an infant grandson, you know, the issue of supply chain problems and the inability to get baby formula became very personal for my family. And I certainly know that I'm not alone. So the aggregation of all of these stressors on American families and businesses, just at that time when we're all trying to recover from a global pandemic that changed the lives of so many people, the impacts are profound and profoundly negative. So, you know, it's really about how these issues affect the individuals. And I see it and I hear it every single day and really can't believe the failure of federal government policy to get ahead of what I think they should have known coming out of COVID, the exorbitant stimulus spending, federal government paying people to stay home instead of going to work, crushed our economy, put businesses out of business, put people out of business, and we're not recovering as we should from that. So it's a compounding effect, in my opinion.
So let's say we do send you to Washington. It seems quite likely, too, and I think this is the other important thing, is that it's quite likely that in the House, in the Senate, that the Republicans will be the majority. And it would be nice if we had a voice on that majority. So I guess my question to you would be, let's say we do send you to Washington. What do you think is the solution? What's the best way we can go about driving down these prices, getting inflation, getting a handle on inflation? What do you think the plan should be?
Yeah, we really have to get federal spending under control. The party in power right now believes that it's okay to print money, that just because we're running ridiculously high deficits, that spending should just go on unchecked, and resetting of priorities. You know, we could talk a little bit about the Green New Deal and the federal government's push to, push their climate agenda and clean energy agenda, that is not taking into consideration the day-to-day impacts on the American people. You know, there's a war on fossil fuels in this country when just 2 years ago, we were energy independent. And I remember that was a really proud moment for me as an American. You know, we didn't have to look to our global foes for our own energy sustainability. But today, our progressive elitist leaders are putting their ideological climate agenda ahead of what's best for the American people. So we can, at the same time, ignite the power of oil and gas in our country while we're moving to cleaner energy alternatives. In my opinion, it's not an either-or scenario, and I think this administration is really stuck in that sort of black or white either or narrative.
Yep. Yeah, I'm with you there. Jamie, when it comes to a lot of these things, I'm like, it doesn't always have to be an either or thing. And I think we get caught up in a lot of that. We got to take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side. There's still more topics, including the war in Ukraine, January 6th and Roe v. Wade being overturned. All things I'd like to ask Jamie Stevenson, former Darien first select woman and the GOP nominee for the 4th Congressional District. We're coming up next here on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM. I'm on the line with former Darien first select woman and GOP nominee for the 4th Congressional District, Jamie Stevenson. Jamie, let me ask you your thoughts on January 6th. Have you been following the evening program that they're running, the Democrats?
Yes, the public hearings. I'm trying to watch those as closely as I can. You know, my general thought on January 6th, I really don't ever believe in taking up violence. It seems that we have become a society of rallies and riots. And some of those riots become violent. We saw it this summer after the murder of George Floyd, and we saw it after the 2020 election. You know, I'm counting on the leaders in our country to bring down the temperature of discourse. That's something that I have experience and skill in doing, rather than the politicians who are fueling the flames.
Yes.
So, I think it's very, very important that we send people to Washington to take up these serious issues that are really going to have the dialogue and don't inflame the issues to make political points with their voters across the country.
Well, especially when you don't, your own voters, you don't generally need to, right? There's not even really a need to do that other than to just get people angry, and that leads to violence.
I'll just add one other thing. I do look to our leaders to really set the tone. And you can either incite or you can calm people. And I think we didn't see what I had hoped to see on January 6th, and that was, you know, a peaceful protest and an airing of thoughts and grievances in a respectful way.
Yep. All right, let's talk about the war in Ukraine. I know you've come out, you're in support of the Ukrainian people. Is there a point where, again, let's say that you're in Washington, if this thing continues or if Putin uses nuclear weapons, any chance you would want to send American troops onto the ground in Ukraine?
So that's a very difficult decision and not one that I'm prepared to make at this point in time. That would have to come with, you know, a lot of information and intelligence. But what I will say is I stand strongly with the Ukrainian people. I've been with the Ukrainian people here throughout our district in Fairfield and many other places. And it's heartbreaking to hear the stories of their families who have either become refugees or have, you know, they're hiding in their basements for fear of being bombed. The issue in Ukraine is so significant because it's much bigger than Ukraine, right?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we have a war in Ukraine going on right now, again, back to that point of how weak America seemed to the rest of the world with how we left Afghanistan. So now, you know, Russia and China are watching to see exactly how we're going to react to these situations around the globe. So there's a lot at stake. I do stand strongly with the Ukrainian people. Certainly, if nuclear weapons become part of this war, that's a game changer. And I hope and pray that the United States will use all of their tools and might to quell a nuclear risk like that.
All right. And the last thing I want to ask you about, and I want to tie in two things because we're not going to have a ton of time for this, but I know you're a crusader for mental health. I know you also hold women's issues near and dear to you. Your thoughts on overturning of Roe v. Wade?
Yes, this is very significant for me. You know, again, as a mom, I have four daughters, I have two grandchildren, and I think last Friday's decision, in spite of the historic leak of that draft decision, it really blindsided women across the country. I'm a strong supporter of women's rights and our right to make all personal medical decisions with our doctors and families, including that painful decision sometimes for abortion. But I do want to say how deeply frustrated I am with perpetuating these labels. You know, we're now always sorted by labels, and you're either pro-life or you're pro-choice on this matter. And I don't believe that to be true, because those labels don't even come close to acknowledging the complexity and the seriousness of this issue. Friday's decision has set medical equity for women back 50 years. We cannot spend another 50 years fighting to get that back. So, you know, Jim Himes has been in Washington for 13 years, and for 13 years, he had the ability to bring this issue up in Congress.
Yep.
And codify this medical equity issue for women once and for all. And he's done nothing. So when I'm your congresswoman in Washington, I want to immediately explore the proper role that Congress can play in ensuring that medical equity for women exists across this country for everyone.
Jamie Stevenson, I am so excited for you. Again, just opened up the headquarters in Fairfield. I think you're fantastic. I really appreciate you cutting some time here for me today. I wish you all the best. And I feel like you've passed all of my tests. As far as I'm concerned,
thank you, Jeff.
Jamie, you are good to go. And best of luck to you going forward. I think you would serve us very well in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much. I really look forward to being out in all of our 17 communities, meeting people and talking with individuals about their questions and concerns. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I can't wait to get out there.
She is a new breed of Republicans. I think she's fantastic. I hope everybody else does, too. My next guest is one of three Connecticut Republicans who will be primarying in August for the chance to take on Dick Blumenthal. The candidates being Themis Claridis, Leora Levy, who we'll be talking to tomorrow, and currently on the line with Pete LaMage. We had a chance to talk to Pete last time I was on. Pete, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Pete, last time we talked, I'm absolutely blown away by your story. You were born and raised in communist Albania, and you're a different breed. And so let's get into some of these issues right now. And what I want to focus more on is, I know who caused all these problems. How do we fix these things? And let's talk inflation. What do you think the trick is if we send you to Washington to take Blumenthal's spot, assume the Republicans have the majority in both houses? What do you think the proper moves are to rein in inflation?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, no one can argue that in order for us to fix the economy, we can do it without understanding inflation, the Federal Reserve, currency depreciation, price stability. I mean, these are things that we as United States senators, we have to understand them before we try to resolve the issues. Now, the United States Senate is the it's the institution that shapes the president's agenda, if you will. And you would do that. We would do that by advising and consenting the president on nominations, including the Federal Reserve. So what's causing inflation right now is both monetary and fiscal policies. Monetary policies, which are coming from the Federal Reserve, the Fed, and it's printing money and causing currency depreciation and therefore inflation and higher prices. But on the other hand, in addition to monetary policies, we have failed fiscal policies in Congress, and we have to fix both of them. And I think that we start by, reestablishing the original intent of the Federal Reserve, which was the money supply, controlling the interest rates, bringing the price stability, control inflation, and generate trust in the U.S. currency. And the Federal Reserve has lost that mission right now.
Let's talk about this war in Ukraine. I know you're not a big fan of communists, so this thing, I'm stunned that this thing has gone on now for as long as it has. The invasion was in February. Here we are in June. The story's more or less fallen out of the American news cycle. How do we end this war in Ukraine? And I'll ask you this. I just was talking to Jamie Stevenson, asked the same thing. What in your mind would have to happen before you think the United States would get involved, say, with ground troops? Or is that something you wouldn't even consider?
No, I wouldn't. That's one thing we should never consider, because that would trigger NATO to be involved in this war, and that would trigger World War III, no question about it. But when Reagan said that I would rather be feared than respected, the current administration is neither feared nor respected right now by Russia or anyone else in the world, for that matter. What happened in 2008, when Obama was president, Putin was able to take Crimea. And then he didn't do anything with regard to Ukraine when Trump was the president, because he feared that administration. Now, once Biden was elected, he took over Ukraine and invaded Ukraine. So what we need to do, we just have to strengthen the position of the United States again. And right now, we're kind of weak, actually. Not kind of weak, we're very, very weak, and nobody fears this administration. So the midterm election would be extremely important. I would say that this election in November, it's one of the most significant elections since Reagan, if not since Lincoln. This will define the future of this country as to whether we survive as a republic or not. And this is why I think you see millions, at least a million people, have switched parties from Democrat to Republican. If you saw the article today in New York Post, that people are leaving the Democrat Party because the Democrat Party has become an anti-American party. So we have to strengthen Republicanism, strengthen the administration, and make sure that we are both feared and respected again in the world.
All right, Pete, we've got to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about two things. The overturning of Roe v. Wade. I know you're very conservative. I'm sure you're very happy about that. I also want to ask you a little bit about January 6th. I don't know if you've been following the January 6th commission performance that they're doing on television. We're on the line with Pete LaMarche, one of three Republican candidates. August 9th is the primary. Pete LaMarche, Themis Claridis, and Leora Levy, who I'll be talking to tomorrow afternoon, all will be vying for the chance to run against Dick Blumenthal. And you know, Pete, it seems like the Republican Party really feels like that you talked about the importance of this election. The Republican Party is like in Connecticut for these elections, and I think that means something.
Well, the Republican voters are going to have to get it right this time, because what happened with the Republicans in the past, from 2006 to present, we have lost every statewide election because we have pretty much the party anointed weak candidates, and they were not able to fight against the Democrats as true Republicans, and they were afraid to be conservative. So what separates me from the other candidates, actually, is the fact that I have remained consistently conservative since I got involved in politics in 2012. I never changed my positions on anything. And when you have other Republicans running for the same position, that change positions and you know, in accordance to the current situation, I think that should concern us, because we don't need another Liz Cheney or Mitt Romney in the United States Senate or Congress. You need a true Republican with the backbone, the character, and the fortitude to protect and defend the Constitution, uphold the Constitution, and fight for this country to reestablish republicanism again. And that would be me if the voters give me a chance on August 9th.
Not sure if you saw the polls today, but we're looking right at about that same 70% of Americans are disapprove of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. Obviously, in this state, things are a little bit different. Knowing the demographics of this state, Pete, knowing that 50% of the people of the state are Democrats, about 32% are Republicans, people are very upset about this Roe v. Wade decision. Give me your thoughts, and does that, do you think your stance, I'm certain you're a pro-life guy, that might in any way be troublesome in this election?
No, actually, I'm pro-life, no question about it, and I have always maintained that position, unlike my, counterparts. But look, the Supreme Court, this is not the first time that the Supreme Court overrules itself. If you go back to the 1800s, so Dred Scott case, 1850, when, you know, slavery was, you know, the Supreme Court held it to be legal at that time, and they had to go back and say, hold on, we made a mistake here. Then you go to Plessy versus Ferguson, which was 1896, and it was overruled by Board of Education that we had separate but equal, and the Supreme Court was okay with that until Brown versus Board of Education. So the Supreme Court has gone back time and again and realized that, look, we have reached the wrong decision in the past, and therefore we must fix this. So what happened with these two cases last week, when you look at the Second Amendment case, you have the Supreme Court stating that the states do not have the right to regulate a gun ownership. So they limited the state, if you will, in accordance with the Constitution. Now, when you look at Roe v. Wade, it was not overturned. Roe v. Wade, even Ruth Bader Ginsburg years ago said that it was decided on shaky grounds. So what the Supreme Court said, that the states have the right to regulate abortion, and therefore it goes back to the states, and the states have the right to, you know, restrict it or through the democratic process, which is the voting process that we have. So in both cases, I think the Supreme Court has strengthened constitutionalism, and in the first case by limiting the power of the states not to allow them to supersede the U.S. Constitution. On the Roe v. Wade case, it strengthened the states by sending the case to be adjudicated properly by the voters. So I don't see that as an issue. I see that as a win for constitutionalism. I see that as a win for pro-life, no question about it. But then the most interesting thing about Roe v. Wade is that you have a countervailing interest here, which is the fetus or the baby, and the court was very uncomfortable to send this back to the states, because you have the mother who will decide to a certain extent as to whether to have an abortion or not. But on the other hand, you have the countervailing interest of a baby. So the court got it right, and I'm very happy with it.
You know, in the original Roe v. Wade, they ruled that the Constitution did not include any, when it referred to persons, that they were not counting fetuses. Yeah. And, right, there's a lot of question. Fundamentally, this comes down to, right, when is it a life? The whole idea of, right, from conception or from viability. It's one of those very tricky subjects. But, again, knowing this state is as blue as it is, and knowing how angry people are, you don't see that as an inhibitor to you at all.
No, actually, I don't. I mean, you know, if you were to look at the European countries, 46 out of 50 countries in Europe, they prevent abortion after the 12th week of pregnancy. And they are considered to be quite liberal compared to the United States. The American voters are not happy with the fact that the Democrats are willing to kill a baby even, you know, 2 weeks before, the birth. They're saying that, look, enough is enough. You cannot, you know, they have to define exactly, the Democrats now are going to have to define exactly where do they stand with this. Are they just willing to kill a baby even after birth? I mean, they are going to have to defend their position, and they're going to have to do this through the process of electing or the process of not being able to be elected on this issue. So, yeah, we're going to have a fight, and it's going to be, I think it's going to be a win for the Republicans if they are not afraid to maintain the position that Roe v. Wade going back to the states is a constitutional matter, therefore should have been there years ago from 1973 when it was decided to shake the grounds.
August 9, 2022, the Republican primary between Peter Lamage, Themis Claridis, and Leora Levy with the chance to run against Dick Blumenthal this coming November. Pete, appreciate you coming back on. We'll definitely talk to you again before the election.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.